This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Orrin Pilkey's been sounding the alarm about climate change and sea level rise long before the topics were part of the public consciousness, and his work was not well received in those days. But he pressed on. Today, he has authored and edited dozens of books about the changing environment. He teamed up with his son, Keith Pilkey, for the latest book, Sea Level Rise, A Slow Tsunami on America's Shores. It takes a look at the unexpected ways rising water will affect the lives of people across the country, including the need to establish escape routes and threats to nuclear power plants and other critical infrastructure. Orrin Pilkey is James B. Duke Professor Emeritus of Earth Sciences at Duke University and joins us now. Welcome back.
I'm pleased to be here.
Tell us again, you know, kind of remind us what we already know are some of the signs that things are really beginning to change and change quickly. I'm thinking of sunny day flooding, for instance.
Yeah, sunny day flooding, the importance of that is that it is caused by sea level rise. And so it is the indication of sea level rise that makes a believer out of those that don't believe.
What is it?
It is the rise. It's the spring tide, the normal very high tide at a full moon, but it's extra high because the moon is a little closer to the Earth than it is at any other point. Most places get two or three big sunny day floods, or king tides as we call them, per year or so. And places like Norfolk, Virginia, and Annapolis, Maryland, have particularly big floods. Recently, I saw the Front Street in Beaufort, North Carolina, flooded by just 2 or 3 inches of water.
And these are becoming regular events. They're not unusual anymore.
They're becoming regular, and they're becoming higher. Yeah.
Higher and higher. And so this is not, because, you know, some of the pushback we hear is, hey, these things are seasonal. There are these periods, 7 years on, 7 years off. We've seen higher, we've seen lower. It's nature's way.
You know, there's no indication of that. This looks like a steady march forward, and it's all part of global climate change, almost for absolute certain. There are some questions and some uncertainties about how fast and how far, but this is global climate change at its worst.
And we're talking about some other things that, again, people are beginning to notice every day, a lot more dead trees as a result of rising tides.
Yeah, that's one of the fascinating things of driving to the coast from the Piedmont. As you get close to the coast, you begin to see in most roads, like 64 going to Nags Head, you see more and more dead trees. And if you drive around on the mainland, not on the island, but on the mainland, you see in some cases more than 100 and 150 acres of dead trees, which are caused by the flooding. As sea level rises, it kills the roots, or it raises water, fresh water, up and causes the roots to drown. In any event, it's another measure, another absolute evidence that sea level rises is upon us.
So that's the proof. There's some evidence, but then it becomes a dynamic effect, it seems to me, because one of the things I understood trees do is lock the soil in and keep the erosion from, it slows it down. If we lose those trees, we accelerate erosion?
Maybe. Well, we could. Yeah, we will sell. As long as it's going to be a long time for those dead trees to disappear, that's another generation.
Got
so,
it.
But yeah, if you remove them, that's going to create problems.
How you started documenting these changes decades ago, long before people were taking it seriously, right?
Yes, it was quite exciting in the old days. I was somewhat controversial, not among scientists, but among perhaps developers and the Corps of Engineers.
Well, developers are still not crazy about your work, right?
I think that's quite true. I think I'm considered public enemy number one by some of them, partly because they continue to develop even though all this evidence of sea level rise is upon us, and the evidence is that we're going to have probably something of the order of 3 feet sea level rise by 2100. And so many of the buildings that we see, especially along North Carolina shoreline, because we have almost entirely a barrier island shoreline, and barrier islands are extremely vulnerable to sea level rise, and especially on the Outer Banks. And one hopes Well, it's going to take some time, but it is getting better. More and more people are recognizing it.
Well, there was a time when, I mean, you were one of the first to raise the problems created by seawalls, and people were not taking you seriously at all at first, right? Tell us about that whole journey.
Yeah, that you know, there's no question about it now. On an eroding shoreline, if you build a seawall if you try to stop the shoreline in any way, you're going to lose the beach. Now, the beach may disappear in a few months, or it may disappear in a few years, but the beach will be gone. And that was painful for people to, especially for the Corps of Engineers, who thought the logical way to stop sea level rise and the logical way to stop erosion is to build seawalls. What else are you going to do? But that turns to pay a very heavy price. You end up with a beach community without a beach, and that became more and more obvious, especially in New Jersey. We learned from New Jersey. New Jersey went there first, and they taught us all what happens with seawalls.
What are some of the areas of in the country now that are worst affected, and what are the effects?
Well, I guess the biggest cost, well, perhaps the cities are the big problem. Boston is a problem because the whole downtown area of Boston is fill, low elevation fill. Miami is doomed. Miami sits on top of a very permeable, porous limestone, and so you can't build a seawall to stop the sea rise. The water is just going to come up right into the city, and New Orleans is also doomed, but in a different way. As sea level rises, the more and more hurricanes will go over the dikes and make the city unlivable.
And those cities are already feeling it. I mean, more and more businesses are routinely having to bail out, to pump themselves out just as part of their normal business operation.
Yes, that's true. And there's that good strong evidence now that the price of property in some of the areas that are going to be affected by a sea level rise is dropping, or is not rising as much as it might otherwise.
Talk about the effects of infrastructure, things we don't, I mean, nuclear power plants. Well, let's start with nuclear power plants, and then we'll get to what we're
Oh, boy, nuclear power plants. The one that bothers me the most, that impresses me the most, is the Turkey Point reactor, which is just south of Miami, and it is very low. Then there's another one on Hutchinson Island, Florida, that I remember. I didn't even know about this, and I was driving up the Florida coast, and there was this nuclear reactor on a barrier island of all things. It looks to me like the elevation, the base elevation of that reactor is about 3 feet. And I of course, the reason they're built there is because they need water to cool. And like our South Point reactor that we have in North Carolina at the coast. Besides reactors, we also have things like all of our ports, especially Long Beach, California, and New York, and so forth. All of them are going to have to be raised. Docks are going to have to be raised everywhere, and that's true all over the world. Right. And that's going to be a major cost. Not only the docks, but all the major ports have large areas where they store the containers and things like that. And those are going to go underwater as well. I mean, the future of ports globally is really something that has to be looked at very carefully.
Well, and of course, you think about the nature of the port, the very fact that it's precisely that inlet of exposed land that makes it a port. Once it's all underwater, how is it any different from any other sort of coastal point?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly it. Ports, of course, are all, by definition, are at low elevation, of course, and definition have water right there.
Now, where this comes, you know, sort of runs afoul of American politics, I think, is clear when the folks at Norfolk, the largest U.S. naval base perhaps in the world, they found their peers having to raise their peers. Tell us that story.
Yeah, three years back, the Navy raised two of their docks, I think. And they said the reason they said they moved it because the wires, there were cables that were underneath the docks, were deteriorating due to high tides and so forth, and we fell for that. And in the book, but it turns out what actually happened is they had to use that as a justification for the raising of the dock because they felt that the legislature, the national legislature, would not fund it if they were told that it was for sea level rise. Wow. And that's a really sad thing. That's right. A really sad thing that here we're trying to respond, the military is trying to respond to sea level rise, and we have to play these games.
Well, it makes you wonder what else, because again, the part of the military's job is to forward plan, think 5, 10, 15 years out. Where will the theaters of war be? What will be the causes of war? To what extent are global warming going to be part of both changing the landscape, but also a cause for war? And if they can't tell Congress what they're thinking, it plays on national security questions.
Yeah, we in the book, we look at the military as leading the way to a global, and other militaries in other countries are leading the way. What's going to happen because of sea level rise? And they are going to respond. There's good indication that the Syrian conflict started as a result of a major drought, when brought all kinds of people into the cities, producing a lot of young men with nothing to do, and that started the crisis in Syria. And there's going to be, for sure, more crises like that.
Other infrastructure are implicated in this, wastewater treatment plants, for instance.
Yeah, as it turns out, wastewater treatment plants are almost all at low elevation, and because it makes it easier for the sewers to go down to get it there. And we have a photograph of a huge wastewater treatment plant in Los Angeles. It's right on the beach. There's a seawall in front of it, but it's still right on the beach, and that's true here in North Carolina, for example, in the communities behind the Barrier Islands, what we call the Inner Banks. There are several wastewater plants which are right at the level of the water, and they'll be the first to go. So how serious is that when you have no sewage plant?
Well, particularly if you know that if you have to have the accident before you move the plant, which tends to be our habit.
Yes, one would hope that in the future we'll begin to look ahead like the military does. The rest of us ought to look ahead like the military does and assume the sea level is going to rise 3 feet. It could rise, by the way, more than 3 feet. A sea level rise of 6 feet is not an impossibility by any means, by 2100.
No. It's happened in fact. You've been doing a lot of thinking, too, about evacuation plans since the campfires in Paradise, California. So let's think about that, because I guess we all have these. If I've seen evacuation route signs, we've got them. Are we okay?
We had all kinds of evacuation problems for Katrina and for Hurricane Wright. I got another one in Louisiana that occurred the same year, and a hurricane that came by Charleston. But the whole thing was emphasized so much by the fire in Paradise, California, where it was a community that had carefully planned their evacuation, and they were going to move out, evacuate people in this part of the city first, and then that part, and that part. And everything fell apart because everything was too fast, but that's kind of like a hurricane. You don't always know how severe it's going to be. Well, they ended up having to get bulldozers to push cars out of the way that had been stalled. When you evacuate, you can bet for sure that people are going to have flat tires, they're going to run out of gas, they're going to have fender benders and so forth. And on our outer banks in particular, and some of the other islands, we have two-lane highways. And can you imagine moving thousands of people quickly down? Actually, usually it'd be the one lane of the two-lane highway. So evacuation is a serious problem. And since we expect intensification of storms now because of the heating of the ocean, evacuation is going to be even more important for us to be considered ahead of time. One way to do this is to leave a lot ahead of time before the evacuation orders come out.
Yeah, leave now, and you'll be in good shape. And as you point out, I mean, running out of gas, when it's a catastrophe, the gas stations are closed. So you're not going to get off the Outer Banks, right?
They're not only closed, but in some cases in the past, they've run out of gas.
Right, right.
So there have been so many.
But what do you tell people? I mean, I know, you know, maybe if you're talking to people with a second home about and talking to developers, yeah, and maybe we don't use tax money to replenish and sort of create the moral hazard that makes it easy to move there. I mean, that's one thing. But what about people who live there all their lives for generations and really can't, or even in low-lying floodplains, for instance, that are also affected by this? You know, people say move, and they say, we can't. We live here. We've been here for generations.
That's evacuation is going to have to be more than just storm evacuation. There's no question about that. They're talking about Miami producing as many as 4 million climate refugees within 30, 40 years. And where are they going to go? That's the big problem. We should be planning for this climate, for the climate refugees. There's no question about that. But that hasn't happened yet. We're a long ways from that. And if you're evacuating for a storm, you ought to think ahead of time. If you're living down there, you ought to think, where am I going to go? Visit Aunt Susie in Atlanta or something like that? But that, most people are kind of evacuating as a disaster, and have not really planned. And it's so, and people have lived there all their lives. They don't want to leave, and they don't want to leave their house. They don't want. But there comes a time when you're going to have to leave the house, either from a storm or sea level rise.
What do we do about that? Or even historical in communities, particularly communities of color that have been in some ways condemned to live there for historical reasons and now have made it their home. They've been given the lowlands, the low-lying areas. This is their home now. What are we gonna, and, you know, it's hard to make a living. How are we going to manage that kind of a move when people can't afford to do it?
Yeah, Princeville, North Carolina, is an example of this. A community primarily of color that, but we should take this into account. We should be, when people, this goes back to the evacuation because of sea level rise problem, we should be not having people rushing down like they did during the Dust Bowl or something like that. We need to plan for this, and we need to think about providing jobs and industry. Perhaps some industries in certain areas would like to have more people. I think this can be done peacefully and efficiently, but it's sure not being done now.
Right. It seems to me enormous opportunities for economic development if you're talking about planning for a rational change that addresses the inevitable before the crisis is really here.
I think that's exactly the way to look at it. That it's a fantastic opportunity for economic development. And at the same time, it solves another really big problem.
And your book includes a guide to speaking with friends and family who may be living in those coastal areas. And maybe these are people's second homes. These are people who are a little better off financially who don't want to hear the bad news. How do we talk to them?
Yeah, in one part of the book, we talk about what the advice that we would give to our family, which means that it'd be this much stricter advice maybe than you give to the world in general. We, for example, we would argue that old people, like my aging parents back in the old days, I wouldn't want them to live on the Outer Banks. If they have to live on a barrier island in North Carolina, they should live further south. But I'd rather they didn't do that. I'd rather old people live on the mainland. And then when you're choosing a home site, I would say you better choose something that's high. You know, elevation instead of location, 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 it's elevation, elevation, elevation. Mm-hmm. And that is not the complete answer, because you need to know the roads that are coming to you. There are many, for example, in Miami, there's a 16-foot ridge along and through much of the community. And you could, at 16 feet, you're going to be pretty safe for a while. But the roads coming to that 16 feet are going to, some of them are as low as 2 feet.
You may not get in and get out. It's like that old thing you do with your doctor. You say, "Doctor, if it were your mother, so I would ask you, Doctor, if it were your planet, What would you advise me to do? But I can't take that advice now because we are out of time. Orrin Pilkey, James B. Duke Professor Emeritus of Earth Sciences at Duke University, co-author of Sea Level Rise, A Slow Tsunami on America's Shores. Orrin, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks.
Orrin, by the way, going to be talking about the book at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, Thursday, September 26th. We got it at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, Harper Lee's unfinished true crime novel is revisited by author Casey Sepp. Stay tuned.